All right, everyone. You know what that means? It's time once again for an installment of my podcast from yours truly. As you may have noticed from the previous little ditty that I was playing, this has to do with the topic that has seemingly become of interest late, particularly in forensic circles, about childhood and adolescent psychopathology of an antisocial nature. As most of you know, for any of you who are familiar with the current taxonomy of the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, currently in its undergoing its fifth revision, supposedly to be released next year, but I've been saying that for a couple of years now, so who knows. At any rate, one cannot give a diagnosis of antisocial personality disorder to a person who is less than 18 years of age. Now, of course, the problem becomes, what do you do when you see antisocial-like pathology in someone who is younger than 18? And therein lies the problem. A lot of folks have seemingly averted or skirted this problem by using the terms psychopath or sociopath to describe behaviors that aren't necessarily quote-unquote of a DSM diagnostic nature. As the listener may or may not know, there are no such terms as psychopath and sociopath in the current version of DSM, and frankly haven't been there for many years. In the olden days, those terms used to mean something clinically from a diagnostic perspective, in the sense that if you were a psychopath, that was a term that described folks who just sort of, the talking heads might say, psycho killer, qu'est-ce que c'est? It was folks who were just out randomly killing people without seeming any basis to do so other than their own pathology. A sociopath, on the other hand, was sort of the subgroup of folks who were serial killer types, and who belonged to a group of folks and adhered to a certain, if you will, code of ethics, and I use the term loosely, obviously, such as a hitman of the mafia, for example. So there was a code of honor, there was a code of ethics that folks killed under certain conditions, but they killed under certain circumscribed scenarios. They weren't just random killers of folks, just ho-hum, you ticked me off, I think I'm going to slit your throat or hang you from a clothesline kind of thing. These were programmed hits, and folks were sent out to kill folks for specific reasons. And killers who belonged to this group of folks who killed people according to certain codes were known as sociopaths, because they're implying they were socialized pathological folks who killed according to a certain set of rules or guidelines, so to speak. What you'll often see in the current schemata seems to be a return to this old term of psychopath to describe folks who were killing people who are under the age of 18, killers who were under the age of 18, that is, and who just seemingly don't seem to have a conscience. So they engage in what we would call antisocial behaviors, but they're described as being psychopaths. There's a recent television show which has appeared, I think, on the Biography Channel called Killer Kids, which talks about that a lot and profiles real-life cases. Interestingly enough, most of the cases seem to come from either Canada or England or France, which I think is pretty interesting, not to say that those countries are any quote-unquote sicker or more populated with pathological kids than America. That just seems to be the folks that they like to profile, seemingly. At any rate, part of the question that gets lodged in this program, and I think a lot of discussions I've seen on recent boards, are can you call a kid who's under 18, can they really be a quote-unquote psychopath, or is this just a confused developmental kid or whatever? And if this person really is a psychopath, what's the reason for that? You know, is it a hereditary thing? Is it an environmental thing? And I think you'll see that nature-nurture, so to speak, controversy with a lot of psych disorders and a lot of conditions in general. Certainly, I think we can all think back to folks we know who have a myriad of conditions or scenarios who would qualify for DSM disorder, such as post-traumatic stress disorder, let's say, PTSD. And, you know, we know people who have PTSD for a variety of reasons, and we know other folks who've undergone some pretty, what most of us would consider to be, quote-unquote, traumatic events that did not result in the person developing a trauma syndrome that would be classified under the DSM code for PTSD. And yet we see other people who go through much less what we would classify as severe life scenarios that just seem to decompensate. And that's the similar kind of scenario, you know, which begs the question, is this an inherited something or is this an environmental something? And I think most folks who have some knowledge in the area, regardless of whether you're talking about PTSD or antisocial personality disorder or whatever, would say it's both. It's a nature and it's a nurture thing. Certainly, if you look at the history of most serial killers, whether they be of childhood nature or adult nature, most of them have had, or a good portion of them at least, have had pretty negative childhood scenarios, some of them pretty severe, that I think any of us would go, okay, I get it. I see why these guys have gotten kind of derailed, if you will. But certainly, I think it's a combination of both, because obviously environmental scenarios alone cannot create anything in and of themselves unless they're just incredibly severe. And this is, of course, my own opinion. I think you'll find most, or at least a large proportion of experts who will probably agree with me on this. You can't just take some environmental event and blame it on the environmental event. It's like a lot of these people I see, for example, during the 80s tried to say, oh, the reason all these kids, you know, committed suicide is because they were listening to Ozzy Osbourne or they were listening to Judas Priest. And, you know, you saw all these great court cases come up where parents were suing the record companies and the artists for, you know, causing suicides, listening to, you know, so-called backmasking, which is, you know, artists supposedly embedding things in under the songs, so-called covert or secret messages, or if you played the song backwards, it said something, and there was a big hoopla about that, which sort of led to, you know, the PMRC and all that foolishness of the late 80s, which I considered to be tripe, frankly. And my contention in that whole period was there's a whole slew of folks who listen to heavy metal and recognize it's just fantasy music or it's just an escape or it's just a catharsis. They have no interest in going out and committing crimes. They have no interest in killing themselves. They have no interest in blowing people up or torturing people or kidnapping people or anything else that society would consider to be heinous. You know, and these folks are no more in league than with the devil than Boris Karloff or Bela Lugosi playing Frankenstein and Dracula were vampires or monsters or monster makers or evil scientists or crazy. They're playing a role or they're acting out a fantasy, a lot of your rock guys are doing the same thing, people. This is for money. These guys are putting music out, and gals that are putting music out for entertainment, catharsis, money, theater show, whatever. The fact that the mere music can corrupt these people's minds and make them, quote-unquote, do things, to me, is ridiculously ludicrous. And the situation is the same, I think, for these killers and folks that act out against society in very antisocial ways. Regardless of the scenario, I think you have to have both a genetic preponderance for this sort of thing, or a genetic weakness, if you will, coupled with some pretty nasty environmental scenarios. Most of your cluster B personality disorders, for example, have an inherited proclivity to them, just as a lot of your addictive disorders do, and as in some cases of limited so-called endogenous or genetically based depression. Certainly schizophrenia has a genetic loading, as does bipolar disorder. But let us not forget that all of these disorders have a predisposition to develop certain kinds of traits and characteristics and or full-blown disorder traits in the persons that inherit them. And the predisposition is very, very different from predetermination, and I think folks sometimes get those confused. And just to clarify, if you have a preponderance towards or predisposition towards a certain disorder, what that means is you're more likely in a significant sort of way than the average Joe or Jolene in the neighborhood, so to speak, in the population for your age and sex-normed group, your so-called cohorts, to develop this disorder. For example, a lot of addictive disorders have that weight, and in fact, in my own family, addictive disorders run on both sides of my family, and I'm a guy who's never been drunk, much less tried anything else or smoked pot or done anything, you know, other than tea and coffee. And usually when I drink coffee, it's decaffeinated because I have a sleep disorder, which I unfortunately inherited and manifested, which runs on my mom's side of the family. But I did not develop an addictive disorder, and they run on both sides of my family in pretty heavy-duty quantities, so to speak. My parents are not, but many people in their sides, respective sides of their family, have a variety of addictive disorders, including narcotic analgesics and a variety of narcotics and alcohol and cigarettes and that sort of thing. And I'm also allergic to cigarette smoke, so I don't smoke cigarettes, never have. So, you know, you're talking to a guy who's been playing hard rock and heavy metal since he was 11 years old and has never been drunk or stoned or anything else and never had any desire to do that stuff, because I just didn't want to tempt fate, because that stuff runs in my family. And just because you have a predisposition for that sort of thing doesn't mean you're going to become one. And, you know, one of the ways you avoid that, if you have that in your family tree, so to speak, is you just don't get started. And, you know, thank God we don't need drugs and alcohol to live. So given that scenario, I've just chosen to abstain from any and all drugs, with the exception of theophylline and tea, which is the psychoactive ingredient in tea. People think tea has caffeine in it, but it really has theophylline predominantly in it. Coffee has caffeine in it, and I certainly do coffee, and that is a drug, so let's not minimize that situation. But other than those, I don't, and I drink on rare occasions, and I do mean rare occasions, and I never have more than one and occasionally two drinks, and that's it. I'm a, as I jokingly describe myself, I'm a nerd and a cheap date, so I don't do that kind of stuff. It's just too risky for me, given my family history and both sides of my family, so I avoid developing the disorder by simply not engaging. Cluster B personality disorders, the so-called cluster Bs, which include the infamous antisocial personality disorder, of which we speak, and antisocial traits, narcissistic personality disorder, what I call a person who's a legend in their own mind, or as one of my friends so accurately described, narcissists, they think they're hot shit and they're not even warm diarrhea, which I thought was a scream. The borderline personality disorders, the famous folks depicted in movies such as Mommy Dearest, Play Misty for Me, Fatal Attraction, The Crush, Single White Female, those are all borderlines. And the famous histrionic personality disorder, which I jokingly refer to as Prissy Syndrome. Prissy is the name of the black chick on Gone with the Wind who goes, "Lord of the sky, Lord of nothing about mother, no babies." Right? That's histrionic, overly dramatic, you know. All the world's a stage, and I'm the principal actor in it, so pay attention to me at all times kind of thing. Everything's a drama. Everything's 1 to 10 kind of dealy. So those are all also have a genetic loading, and unfortunately, cluster B disorders run in my father's side of the family. So, you know, I just try to avoid any and all scenarios that involve that sort of thing, so I don't want to be developing those kinds of traits. So one doesn't necessarily have to have a disorder just because it runs in the family, so to speak. It has a genetic loading or predisposition. Okay. That's very different from determination, which means if you've got it, you're going to get it. There's no way. It's a one-to-one correlation kind of thing. Right? That's a very big difference. So certainly there are genetic loadings for certain disorders, certain anxiety disorders, some fall in that also. But what I see those as, if you will, genetic weaknesses, or make folks a little more susceptible to developing certain traits and certain behaviors and certain syndromes as opposed to their age and sex norm counterparts. If you couple that with a very abusive type environment, particularly early on, or you couple that with a very cold or aloof environment, or you couple that with a dangerous environment, like living in a war zone, you know, or having a parent who's schizophrenic trying to kill you, or being repeatedly sexually or physically and emotionally abused in a very severe kind of way, being beaten often or raped or exposed to that sort of thing, exposed to violence in the family on a regular basis. There's a lot of research that has indicated that being exposed to violence is almost as bad as being a victim of violence up front, so that if you're a person who witnesses violence in the home a lot, you can become just as traumatized as the person on whom the violence is perpetrated. So one has to be careful with that. But be that as it may, if you have those kinds of experiences and then you couple those with a predisposition to have certain syndromes or traits, or you have certain genetic weaknesses, for example, then the likelihood of you developing a more sociopathic type or psychopathic, however you want to say it, a more antisocial attitude, it becomes higher. Again, there's no one-to-one correlation between those things, because there's people who go through pretty horrific things that come out. Maybe they have trauma, maybe they have PTSD, maybe they have some anxiety or depression, but they don't develop into serial killers or rapists or child abusers or abductors or whatever. So part of that also has to do with this concept of resiliency, which was studied pretty extensively in the 70s and 80s up until, I think, the early, maybe to the mid-90s. And I'm not aware of any research that's ongoing on resiliency, but there probably is somebody out there somewhere doing that. And this concept we call resiliency is this thing that says, you know, why do some people make it out of relatively heavy-duty kinds of environments and situations relatively unscathed, whereas their counterparts who aren't as quote-unquote resilient don't. And a lot of the studies that were originally done on this, a lot of the developmental studies done on a longitudinal basis over a 10 or 12-year period were done with folks, inner city folks, of a variety of ethnic and racial backgrounds, but they were all pretty poor. They all had pretty minimal parental interaction, and some of them had downright abusive and traumatic childhoods. And what they did was try to follow these group of folks to see who would come out relatively okay, meaning they didn't die suicide, become drug addicts, become drug dealers, become prostitutes or pimps or gangbangers, or end up in prison or kill other people or whatever, that they ended up developing relatively normal lives, holding a job, being a productive part of society, whether it was a mailman or a shop owner or a doctor or whatever. And when they followed these kids and compared the kids that made it, so to speak, the kids that were successful in their lives despite their background versus the kids who didn't, what they discovered was this thing they called resiliency, and they couldn't quite say where this thing came from. But it seemed to be something that they sort of had a priori, meaning they just sort of came out of the chute with it, something they as characteristics sort of had. And what this characteristics allowed them to do was the following things. The folks that had resiliency versus the folks who did not were able to see what they were undergoing at the time as a child as a temporary condition. So they said, yeah, you know, life stinks and I've got to, you know, to get to school, I've got to run, take the long way around and avoid the gangs and, you know, the pimps and all these crazy people on the street to get to my classroom, but I can do it. They saw it as a temporary thing. They saw this as a hurdle that they were eventually not going to have to deal with, so that this thing wasn't a permanent, oh, it's always going to be this kind of way thing. Sort of connected to that, they saw life's challenges and vicissitudes in fortune as a challenge and an opportunity for them to demonstrate their mastery over it. So they developed this attitude that they could overcome, that they would that they persevered and would overcome this, that because it was a temporary scenario, they would figure out a way to circumvent it, overcome it, and outlast it, so to speak. So rather than be this awful, terrible, catastrophic, oh my God, what am I going to do, boo-hoo, boo-hoo, poor me, you know, the world sucks and, you know, I might as well, you know, suck back kind of thing, they were much more proactive and saw this as an opportunity for them to challenge themselves and to grow and to become stronger, sort of with the old existential, that which doesn't destroy us makes us stronger kind of adage. Or there's a Chinese character that means in one context crisis and in another context opportunity. And these folks saw this situation of untoward emotional and parental and environmental events as an opportunity, a challenge for them to grow, as opposed to this crisis that could never be overcome and, oh my God, what am I going to do kind of thing. They also had the sense that they mattered, that they were a person, and that as an individual, as a person, that they mattered, that they were worth something, despite the fact they may not be getting a lot of accolades from their peer group, or they may be getting picked on, or they may not have a parent in the home present a lot to give them all this nurturance and affirmation. They had this internal ability to, as the transactional analysis people would say, give themselves self-stroking. And we're not talking about a sexual activity out there for you perverted guys and gals listening to this. We're talking about patting yourself on the back and saying, gosh, I did a really good job, without needing some sort of external validation that you're doing a good job. So you're able to validate yourself doing it, which, by the way, is what I call self-esteem, because if you're waiting for other people to give you strokes, so to speak, to give your self-esteem points, you really don't have self-esteem. People say, oh, you have low self-esteem. Well, what I would say is you have other esteem. You're waiting for other people to give you esteem. That's not self-esteem. These kids had real self-esteem and self-worth, a level of self-worth that they could do. The other thing that they found with the kids who made it out, the so-called resilient kids, was that these kids had a role model. Now, the role model could have been a TV character. It could have been a fictional character. It could be somebody they read about in a comic book or saw on TV in a cartoon, or read about in a novel. It could be a famous sports figure that they somehow aligned themselves with. It could be the local shopkeeper. It could be the next door neighbor. But it was somebody that they perceived to be similar to themselves that they said to themselves, well, hey, this person is kind of like me. This person isn't a serial killer. This person isn't a drug dealer. This person isn't a prostitute. This person isn't a gang member. This person doesn't go around beating people up and doing nasty things. This person makes a living in an honest way and is struggling and doing the best they can and seems to have some ethics and values and morals and this sort of thing. And if this person can do it, I can do it too. So it was this sense of symbolic identification with somebody who was a positive role model for them. And it could have been, as I said, it could be a cartoon character, it could be a real life person. It could be somebody in their neighborhood, it could be a sports figure or a rap or rock star or whatever. It didn't have to be a real person in their neighborhood, so to speak. So these folks had a set of values and attributes that the researchers together labeled as being quote-unquote resilient. And I think what you see is with these kids that are so-called, quote-unquote, psychopaths and sociopaths, who basically are what I would classify as childhood antisocials, or who exhibit antisocial behaviors as children or adolescents. I think what you're going to see is they have a combination of a lack of this resiliency, persistency, ability to overcome this genetic weakness, if you will, coupled with some pretty nasty environmental scenarios, whether it's an absent parent or a parent who is a drug addict or a prostitute or a pimp or abandons them, or they get put into adoption homes that are abusive or whatever. So I think you have a combination of both of those going on. I don't think any one or two factors is going to make anything. You know, it's kind of like people say, you know, what makes a great song? Well, gosh, a lot of things make a great song. You know, a catchy hook, you know, good lyrics, good music, something that you can, that's kind of fun, or something that's either hits you at a very spiritual or existential level. I mean, there's a lot of things that go into making a good song, so to speak. And it's not one or two ingredients any more than it is for a good soup. It's a lot of ingredients and how the ingredients meld together that make a good soup or a good song or a good antisocial, so to speak. Obviously, I'm using the term relatively speaking. But yes, I certainly do think that, you know, people will ask me, do you think that kids can, you know, be real quote-unquote sociopaths or antisocials or psychopaths or whatever? I definitely do think that kids can be quote-unquote evil, perverse, pathological, whatever you want to call it. I think those folks are few and far between. And if you look at their adult counterparts are pretty few and far between. And that's kind of a good thing for us and for them too. I think it's easier to rehab a kid if there's a chance of rehabbing a kid. It's certainly easier to rehab a kid who exhibits these kinds of traits versus an adult who has had more years to practice these traits, and they become more ingrained, and they've also had more developmental impact on the developing brain, so to speak. So if you think about it, you know, you've got a person whose brain is developing, and you have all these negative things that sort of jar the biochemistry of the brain, if you will, as it's differentiating its neurons and growing and developing and differentiating it, it becomes much more pathological to the brain, much more harmful. The earlier these things happen, the more frequently they happen, the more chronically they happen, and the more severely they happen. You know, and you combine that with somebody who has a more fragile, if you will, character makeup or a less resilient makeup, you can really impact the way that the neurons differentiate and really have major impact on a person as an adult. Plus, they get used to doing those sorts of things and looking at the world in a certain way. And, you know, those habitual ways of feeling and acting and thinking sort of become ingrained the longer they go on. And that's pretty much true of anything. I mean, if you think about it, you know, if you practice guitar every day of your life from the time you were 10 or 11, you're going to be a lot better at 40 than the guy or gal who starts at 35 practicing every day, if, you know, other things being equal. So this sort of thing is no different. The earlier you catch it, the less damage it does on the brain, or the later in life that these sorts of things start to happen, typically the less of an impact these kind of things have on a developing brain. This is, by the way, why substance use is so detrimental, if you will. When you get somebody who's in their, you know, young teens, who's starting to use drugs on a pretty regular basis, and by the time they're 15, 15 and a half, they're in the pattern, so to speak, you know, you're having major impact on the biochemistry of the brain doing that kind of stuff. And then if you throw in a psychological tendency disorder, whatever, on top of that, if they happen to be unfortunate and have one of those also, that just makes things uber complicated and much more difficult to treat, which is unfortunately the vast majority of my caseload. But that's for another podcast. At any rate, so the question often becomes, you know, to me, do I think that, you know, pathology is inborn or is it environmental? And I think it's a little of both. I think if the environment is strong enough and if you don't have somebody who's that resilient, you can create some pretty nasty stuff out there in forms of a lot of different stuff. Conversely, if you have somebody who, for whatever reason, has a lot of genetic loading of disorders, potential for disorders, and then doesn't have a lot of resiliency on top of that, sometimes you can have the most benign environments on the planet, and they're still going to develop all this kind of stuff because their system is just uber sensitive, and they just don't have the resources to combat, as Shakespeare might say, the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, to be able to overcome these events and to deal with the other stuff that you and I would normally call the vicissitudes of life. Thankfully, I've only seen a very few of these very young, quote-unquote, antisocial types in my own experience. When I have, they're pretty pronounced and they're pretty flippin' obvious. It's pretty frightening, honestly, when you see this sort of thing happen. I've seen maybe four in my entire experience, and I'm really thankful I haven't seen any more of that in kids who were under 18. But I've seen it in as young as kids are 10 or 11, and just about in every one of the cases where I see these kinds of traits starting to develop, you can see parentally where they get a lot of this junk from. But, you know, again, I can say the same thing about schizophrenia. I can say the same thing about bipolar disorder. I mean, the youngest bipolar kid I ever saw was 14 and a half, and that person had a very replete family history of bipolar disorder in the family. So, you know, you're like, okay, this poor kid, you know, got zapped on all sides of the coin, so to speak. So that's pretty rare. You know, usually you'll see this first episode happen later. You know, usually you'll see somebody with the first manic episode later in their late teen years, just like you see the first psychotic episode typically in the late teen, early 20 years. You know, and again, rule of thumb, earlier you see it, the less well it predicts future accommodation and positive performance, because the earlier it happens, that means it's more pronounced in their genetic pool, so to speak, and that means it's, you know, going to be harder to remediate. It's happening earlier, that's not a great sign. Same thing with these antisocial type indexes. And so a lot of people will say, well, what do you do when you see a kid who's younger than 18 who you really believe to be an antisocial person? And, you know, my response is it varies. I mean, it depends on how convinced I am. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of things that could be involved in that, and I certainly don't want to limit somebody by putting a label on them that may follow them for the rest of their life, sort of thing. What you'll see most clinicians do in these cases is they will give the kid, you know, what they can, which is usually a severe conduct disorder. I don't know if most of you know this, but in order to be diagnosed antisocial personality disorder, even after 18, you either have to have a conduct disorder diagnosis on the books, so to speak, or you have to be able to have given a conduct disorder diagnosis to this person, I think, prior to age 15, based on their history. So had they come to see a therapist during those years, they would have qualified based on their historical behaviors for a diagnosis of conduct disorder in order to be diagnosed antisocial as an adult. So what most folks will do is give these people a severe conduct disorder. Occasionally what I've seen is they'll give the person disorder, personality disorder not otherwise specified. The not otherwise specified category in the DSM is, they have that in every one of the disorders. So there's a substance use disorder not otherwise specified. There's a depression disorder not otherwise specified. It's sort of the garbage can. We don't know what this person has, or this person doesn't quite qualify for a full-blown of this, that, and the other, but they kind of look like, walk like, talk like, smell like, and act like this. So they have this not otherwise specified. They don't quite fulfill all the criteria. So sometimes folks will be given a personality disorder not otherwise specified with antisocial features, or they may even leave that off so as not to hugely contaminate this person. But if the person's really severe, I have seen cases where they'll say personality disorder not otherwise specified with antisocial features, which basically tells the reader you've got an antisocial on your hands, or you've got a budding antisocial on your hands. So, you know, it really depends. You have to be really careful with this kind of thing, because you don't want to pejoritize an individual that they carry this label with them. But at the same time, you don't want to minimize somebody's pathology if they've really got it. And you want to know that, let the treating person who's going to work with these folks know what they're dealing with, so they're not operating under any delusional scenario that this is going to be an easy case or a quick fix, or, oh, gee, they've just got this, because that's not helpful either. So I think you have to really weigh a lot of factors involved when you see these kinds of cases. It all always becomes really difficult. Certainly the earlier you can intervene in these cases, and this is of course true with anything, the earlier you can intervene with these cases, the better off you're going to be. And sometimes intervention has to be at a parental, family level. Sometimes it's an individual level. And every case is different. So you have to really analyze and look at the environmental situation, the family situation, the cognitive level of the person you're involved with, the intellectual level of the person you're involved with, what other emotional disorders or contaminating factors may be involved, what's the environment they live in, and in and around, sort of thing. I mean, there's just all sorts of ways to look at this thing and factors to consider. So none of these things certainly are easy choices, and obviously locking these people away is not going to solve the problem. It's going to protect society, and obviously if you've got folks who out there who are a danger or a threat to society, you have to do something to contain them. But at the same time, if you don't try to go in and fix the problem, you're obviously, it's not going to go away just because you're housing it in a confined environment. As soon as that person is no longer in the confined environment, they're going to go back to doing what they're doing unless you do something to try to remediate that situation. And obviously that's true of anything, any disorder. So there's no real answer here that's easy and quick and painless. It's an ongoing debate and an ongoing problem for society. We have to balance protecting other people, against doing the best for the individual who's got the problem, because even though they're creating problems with their behaviors, let's not forget these people are not quote-unquote normal. And I don't say that in any nasty or pejorative or insulting sort of way. It's just, I mean, these folks, in the vernacular of the South, them boys ain't right, and these folks have an illness, if you will, or a sickness, or a disbalance, a disorder, and they need help trying to get this thing fixed, if at all possible, or at least minimized to the best of their ability. Opposed to just throwing them away, locking the key, or kicking them out of school and saying, okay, you're an asshole, you're gone, or okay, let's put you in jail, do not pass, go, do not collect $200, and do not get out for the next 25 years with no treatment. Obviously, that's not going to solve anything either. So it is a quandary. These folks are very difficult, whether they're adolescents, children, or adults. These folks are very trying in counseling, and it's often very long, labored, and pretty frustrating for the therapist. You have to have a pretty high pain threshold as a therapist for these kinds of folks. But I could also say the same thing for cluster B personality disorders, who are also quite a challenge in therapy. The histrionics, less so, but certainly the borderlines, the antisocials, and the narcissist are just a handful. And it's why most people in my business refuse to see those folks, because they often make false complaints to the licensing board. They often, conjecture all kinds of things in their head that the therapist does or doesn't do, and it's just it's become a nightmare. And even on the best end, they're certainly resilient in their pathology, meaning that they like to hold on to their stuff in the sense that they don't give up their pathology easily, and they're very resistant to change, and it's a difficult and often arduous and long process with these folks. So you have to kind of gird your loins and tighten your seatbelt up, and they have to do the same thing. And it's kind of a rough ride for everybody. And, this is the kind of thing I see a lot in my practice as well. From time to time, I have these folks in overabundance in my practice, and at other times, I have none of them. A lot of my colleagues will say, I don't know why you see these people. If I suspect this is going on, I just turn them away. And my response to that is, well, that's fine, except if you don't treat these people, who the hell is going to see them? And what the heck's going to become of these people? I realize they're a danger to the clinician in the sense that they can, pull all kind of crazy stuff and, call the police and say you raped them and do all kinds of crazy crap. But at the same time, if you don't try to help these folks, who the heck's going to help them? I mean, these are human beings, and you have to have some level of connection to them as a person whether you like their pathology or not, and certainly I despise their pathology with a purple pink polka dotted passion, but the person isn't the pathology, you know, and separating the two out sometimes is real difficult. You know, it's kind of like the old Christian adage, you know, love the sinner, hate the sin kind of thing. You know, hate the pathology, but, you know, respect the individual that has the pathology as a suffering individual, no matter how much you may feel that their pathology is impacting you in a very negative way, and it often does. So there's not an easy answer for this, and certainly families of these folks, particularly as kids and adolescents, go through a tremendous amount of stress and strain and often need a lot of support from their community, often from their spiritual leaders and from the therapist treating their kid. Oftentimes these folks, I recommend that these folks get their own counselor, therapist, whatever, to work some stuff out, because, you know, when you have one of these types of folks living in your home, providing they're sustainable in the home, which some of these kids are and some of these kids are not, you know, it's a tremendous strain on the marriage. It's a if you have a married couple or a committed, you know, partnership couple together, it's a tremendous strain on the other kids if those are the children or adolescents in the family. It's just, it's a real tough road to hoe, and I have a lot of empathy for those folks and a lot of sympathy for those folks. There's no easy answers. You know, life is often difficult, and for these folks, it's incredibly difficult. So I don't mean to sound doomy and gloomy. It is a rough road, and I think that it really puts a lot of people's faith to the test. It puts a lot of people's patience to the test, and as a therapist, it certainly puts your clinical skills and knowledge to the test. In the instances where the person is able to successfully remediate their scenario with your assistance and the assistance of their family and all this kind of stuff, it's an incredibly rewarding experience, but it's really often time-consuming, very energy-consuming, and a very arduous and long process. But if it comes out successfully, it's one of the best things you'll ever experience. It's really rewarding for those folks who stick in. So that's about all I have to say for this installment. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it, and I'll check you later. Thanks a lot. Be well.